Yeah, that was exhausting.
That was too bad. I stay away from it in the front of the room.
It was nice to get improvement because we had those two tests, but in hindsight, it probably was better to do that.
Yeah, it probably would have been better to have your biochemistry and histology on the same day.
But it was nice to do it with us, right?
No. But it would have been nicer to have it in the morning.
We could have had it both.
Both ways.
Well, when we get the final exams, we can have a final exam anytime we want. We can have it on the regularly scheduled day at the regular time. We can have the final exam on any day, actually. Could we please have the final exam in the auditorium? And let's look at the syllabus and see if that is already planned. If I do have a copy of the syllabus here. Ta-da. Final lecture exam is scheduled for the 10th of December. What day is that?
Wednesday.
Okay. And that will be scheduled in the auditorium. December 10th. Lecture exam, December 10th, on a Wednesday, in the auditorium. Cool. That's perfect then. Much, much better. So I will put a copy of the exam, the lecture exam, on the wall in the histology lab, room 18. It'll be in the back, on those sliding doors on the back of the histology lab. I do not turn back the lecture exam because I use the questions next year. Actually, not all of them. I normally use half of them next year and half new ones.
If we wanted to see our lecture,
then you have to schedule time with me if you want to see your own particular exam. And if you want to go over the questions, too, I'll be very eager to do that. In fact, I think maybe we should schedule a time like Monday evening to talk about the midterm exam in more detail. Because there are certain questions, you might remember that the exam said there were two extra credit questions. Well, actually it turned out that there were six extra credit questions. And how did that happen?
I liked it.
You liked it, huh? Well, what do I do to make that happen? I look at the results, and I see, for example, that question number 53. 68 people missed that question. How many are in here? 80 something. That doesn't look good for me. Question number 52. 45 people missed that question. What I'm getting at is if there's any question here that over half the class missed, I look at that question very carefully. And then I make a decision on whether or not we should add extra credits. So I added four extra credit questions. The downside of that is now the mean is about 3 percentage points higher than last year. The mean is 81%. That's not a downside. It's just that I can't compare as well year to year. Now, many of these questions that you guys missed, the class last year did well on. No, I'm not pointing the finger at you. Who am I pointing the finger at?
Yeah.
Me. We didn't talk about some things as well as we should have. And that's why I would like to meet with you on Monday, because many of the things that I included as extra credit now are critical issues. And we miss them. We miss these critical issues because I want you to do well in pathology class. And if you don't do well in histology class, then the chances of doing well in pathology have decreased. Because pathology is applied histology. We have to do problem solving next year. We have to use these facts that that you're being tested on. Also, part of the exam is to prepare you for the NCLEX, because the upcoming NCLEX exam for you will have a format where there's a little mini case study, and that little case study will be followed by an anatomy question, a biochemistry question, a histology question, and you get the idea. All the basic science questions now are all mixed together. It's a new format for the NCLEX exam, where before there was a separate test for anatomy, separate test for physiology, separate test for this, that, and the other thing. Now there's just one test. If you don't do well in anatomy, but you really crush all the physiology questions, you still have to take the test over. Previous years, if you didn't do well on the anatomy test, you only had to take one test over, the anatomy test, but now you have to take the whole thing over again. So times have changed, and I'm trying to get you ready for this as I think is best. I really didn't like dropping these extra four questions because they covered material that was really important, basic facts, basic concepts, basic material. But statistics are statistics, and numbers are numbers, and clearly something went wrong. And I blame myself. We'll make sure that we do something about that somehow or another. We did part of it right now. So anyway, the mean was 81%. That's very high now. The total possible points were 52, right? Yeah, 52 possible points instead of the original 56. It originally was 56 possible points. Now it's 52. Any questions about that? Okay. I do want to go over those questions, but we don't have time right this moment. We can't do it in lab, so I think I will set aside a time Monday evening to go over some of these questions. If you want to do it that way, or if you want to schedule some time with me. Monday evening. I'm talking like 6 o'clock. Okay, so that this Monday's out. We'll work on it. We'll find some time. Maybe it's on Friday night when you want to go out or something. Okay, let's continue on here. Well, how'd that get so bright? That's good. Let's move forward. I want to finish vascular supply, and I want to talk about basic structural and functional properties of your immune system, because, after all, you're going to be naturopathic physicians, and you're going to be trying to boost the immune system in your patients. It'll be nice to know a little bit about what all the parts are and what all those things do. You'll have a separate immunology course, which is probably one of the best, I think, in the country, because it's far more detailed than most other immunology courses that I've ever seen. And rightfully so, isn't it? It's really important that that happen. Well, you may have had some introduction to immunology before, but I'm going to assume you haven't. So as we get past vascular here, now we start talking about the immune system, we're going to get really down to the basics of all basic histological properties, structure and function. We got to finish this first. We talked about arterioles before, and I'd noticed in picking up the new edition of the textbook that's required for you, he handles it a little bit differently than most people. If you've looked at Ross, you'll notice that he classifies three different sized arteries. The elastic artery is the big one. And then muscular arteries, he's got that in there. But then he takes the small ones, the arterioles, and divides them into two categories. I don't like that much. Look at the table in Ross. Don't get confused when you read it and compare it with notes you've taken in here. I agree. Elastic arteries, muscular arteries, we both agree on that. But I don't think it's necessary to break the small arteries into two categories. And And his two categories are small arteries and arterioles. Small arteries, he says, have smooth muscle cells up to 10 layers and maybe down to 6 layers. And how many layers we got here? We got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Traditionally, arterioles have been described as small arteries that have 8 smooth muscle cell layers or less. And that's what I'd like to, that's the definition I'd like to use, that arterioles have anywhere between 1 to 8 smooth muscle cell layers. We also said that they're about 1 millimeter in diameter as well, so they're very tiny. So this would classify as an arteriole. It's got 7 layers of smooth muscle cell. It's got a internal elastic membrane. I can see where Ross is coming from in his textbook. What he's saying is that those arterioles that have 2 to 4 muscle cell layers don't have an internal elastic membrane. And over the years, everybody's ignored that fact. We assume that all arteries have internal elastic membrane from the smallest arteriole all the way up to elastic arteries. Veins don't show it, do they? The big difference between veins and arteries is that even though there's elastic fibers in veins in the same location, they don't demonstrate a prominent internal elastic membrane. And that helps you in lab. One of the things that helps you in lab identify veins as opposed to arteries. But the other big thing, of course, is that the venules have a very large lumen. It doesn't matter about the number of smooth muscle layers. Just that the diameter of a vein, although this isn't true here, but the external diameter of a vein and the external diameter of an arteriole, venule and arteriole, might be the same, but the lumen is much larger than the venule. Here's a small arteriole with 2 smooth muscle layers, one on the inside and one on the outside. And now, according to Ross, and Ross is correct, that arteriole should not show an internal elastic membrane. So we got it wrong here. And even up there, it's got 1 smooth muscle layer, should not have an internal elastic membrane. Okay. Let's move on. There we go. Okay. So we saw this one last time, too, and we saw with the electron microscope, here's the arteriole with maybe 2 smooth muscle cell layers. And over here is what you would see, an arteriole and a venule of comparable external diameter. And, of course, the venule has a much larger lumen.
I'm sorry. It sounded like you went back and forth. I just want to be clear. The arteries don't have an internal elastic membrane? So the picture
according to Ross's textbook, a arteriole this small would not have an internal elastic membrane. An arteriole this big would have.
Okay, but we're assuming for our purposes.
Any small artery that has 8 layers or less is an arteriole. And for our purposes, we're going to say that they do have an internal elastic membrane. Again, we saw this one before. Here's the venule. Arteriole should not be a problem, should it, in lab. There's a nerve down here. That's kind of tough, isn't it? We looked at this one as well, and we saw that in muscular arteries, those are the ones that you commonly see going to the organ, the ones that you can label in the dissecting lab because you saw it and you dissected it out, and it's sometimes called a distributing artery, but it has quite a few smooth muscle cell layers. 10 and above, and it's a larger diameter. Remember the femoral nerve and the femoral artery and the femoral vein? Where did you find those three?
Femoral triangle.
Femoral triangle. VAN. Vein, artery, and nerve. Remember that little trick?
Mm-hmm.
Vein, artery, and nerve. Well, we're going to talk about neurovascular bundles here shortly. And we'll see that oftentimes even an artery and a vein, arterial and venule, are side by side with a nerve, which you can see later on in the tooth. Okay, so this is stained for elastic fibers, and this one is not. And what we said was focus your attention on the subendothelial connective tissue compartment, which is part of the tunica intima. And we said the reason for that is that that's where atherosclerosis begins. That's where hardening of the arteries and atherosclerotic plaques develop. In muscular arteries, that space is very tiny. In fact, you can't see it in the specimens that you look at in lab. The other thing that we didn't talk about is that muscular arteries and elastic arteries, the biggest ones, of course, also have a vascular supply within the adventitia, including arterioles, capillaries, and venules. And this vascular network is there for what reason? Well, it's to provide blood, to provide nutrients to the rest of the artery. Notice the god-awful name. And that name should be changed, but it hasn't because of the cuteness of histologists and pathologists, I guess. I don't know. Anybody know Latin? You're Latin there. Vasa vasorum. I can just see the Pope saying it. Vasa vasorum. And the Pope would say that because if he says your vasa vasorum is infected, you have syphilis. Syphilis is a lesion of the vasa vasorum. And what is that again? Translate, please. The vessels, orum, of the vessel. The vessels of the vessel. How about if I said nervi nervorium? That would be the nerves of the nerve. This is a nervi vasorum. There's also a nervi vasorum as well. But thank goodness they don't bother with that one. But this one is retained. Stupid. It's retained. And I'm going to ask you to know it. Because of not only syphilis, but also because of one of the most common blood vessel diseases called temporal arteritis, where the vasa vasorum is responsible for the disease, lesions of it. Yeah, and don't worry about diseases. What I'm saying is that there are a number of important diseases in pathology where the vasa vasorum is defective and the blood vessel is injured because of that. So, how does this work? Well, capillaries can be found right in here for a short distance, bringing blood and nutrients into the tunica media. But no capillaries are found in the inner one-third, into inner one-quarter. If there's no capillaries in here, and the capillaries from the vasa vasorum stop somewhere in here, then how do these smooth muscle cells get oxygen and food and vitamins if there's no capillaries in there? Yeah, right from the blood. There's blood up there. And it diffuses through a short ways, but in the muscular, in an arterial, it doesn't matter because an arterial is so small that it can get nutrients easily from the blood itself and the lumen. But these muscular arteries and elastic arteries are so big that you need a combined action of diffusion from the blood flow and capillaries from the Bazaar, Azora. Okay, here's that scanning electron micrograph again, simply to emphasize the fact that when blood leaves the artery, then it recoils because of the elastic properties of the internal elastic membrane, and that elastic membrane now is thrown into folds because the tube has recoiled inward at the time of death. In you and I, in a living state, you would not see an internal elastic membrane that looks like that because there'd be blood in the vessel during life. Now there's no blood, so everything recoils down. The aorta has a gigantic subendothelial connective tissue zone. It has an internal elastic membrane, and it has a very thick tunic and intima, which makes for a nice spacious compartment for atherosclerotic plaques to form. Atherosclerotic plaques don't form in muscular arteries because there's, one reason is because there's no room for the lipid to collect. There's no, not enough space in that tiny little compartment. But in elastic arteries, we have a whole lot of room up here. And where's the endothelium? There. The endothelium isn't indicated, but it's going to be a simple squamous epithelial layer running right along there. Let's put a nucleus in there. Another nucleus. Right there. Notice the elastic fibers haven't been stained with a typical stain, but it doesn't matter. They still are kind of shiny and glassy looking. Notice the vasa vasorum down the adventitia. Here's another picture of an elastic artery, and you can see the elastic fibers stain very poorly in the tunica media. They look kind of shiny and glassy. Here's the vasa vasorum, arterioles, venules, and capillaries. And the tunica intima isn't showing very well in this elastic artery, so therefore I got another one for you to look at that. The internal elastic the internal elastic membrane shows up poorly, but it would be approximately right here. In elastic arteries, that's not very dramatic, even though it seemed to be in this drawing here. That's a drawing, so they made it easier by accentuating something that's not very prominent. And so I'm putting it in here for you. And the point of this is that in the aorta and in the carotid arteries and in the pulmonary artery and the coronary arteries, we have the spacious subendothelial connective tissue. And when you try to find that in the muscular artery, there ain't no hope of finding it because it's so small. The simple squamous cell and the internal elastic membrane, the simple squamous cell, the internal elastic membrane seem to be right up close together, and it requires an electron microscope to see a compartment that is very large in an elastic artery and very small in a muscular artery. Any questions about that? Really important concept here. And so,
did you say you can't really see the tunica intima in a muscular artery?
Right, muscular artery over here, and that's that's simple squamous cell and the internal elastic membrane seem to be right up against each other. Here, the simple squamous cell and the internal elastic membrane are far apart. And so this shows this scourge of Western civilization and the scourge of the American lifestyle, where a plaque begins to develop between the simple squamous endothelium and the internal elastic membrane in large arteries, elastic arteries, and in fact, the largest of muscular arteries as well, because these plaques develop in blood vessels inside your cranium, And those vessels aren't really elastic arteries, but they're large muscular arteries. So here we'll talk about all these details in pathology class. Veins, there's the classification scheme. And notice that, and you already knew this, veins have valves and arteries don't. Why would you expect a whole lot of valves in the veins in your leg?
Prevent
the blood from flowing down by the force of gravity, because we got to get blood up the leg. We don't want to go back down again, so we have valves. It turns out lymphatic vessels also have valves. One reason, of course, is the pressure is so low in veins. The gravity could exceed the directional pressure of the venous blood flow. So to prevent that from happening, we have valves. We also have valves in other veins as well. What's a neurovascular bundle? VAN. Vein, artery, and nerve as they lay side by side. Here's the comparison between a muscular artery and a vein. They have the same external diameter. The outside diameter is the same. However, the internal diameter, which you can see here in the vein, is much larger, and that's produced by the fact that the tunica media is much smaller than the artery, and generally, the tunica adventitia is much larger than in an artery. But the overall result is a vessel with a large lumen. Notice the vasa vasorum in both the artery and the vein. Again, venule above, arterial here, arterial there, tiny little nerve there, some more arterioles here. We've seen that one before. Okay, so that ends the story of the blood vessels. Now let's look at the big blood vessel, the one that formed the pump. And these structures here, indicated on this slide, are structures that I can't believe I'm saying this, but are best studied in physiology class. And so you will have studied most of the function of these. I shouldn't say that, really, because you're also going to study this very thoroughly in anatomy class in the second quarter, in the winter quarter. So we don't have anything to say about this, except you need to be ready for pathology class and understand congestive heart failure and myocardial infarction. So this is obviously some important basic things which your journey into the heart began in college or before, as you were studying this in general health class a long time ago. But we, in histology, need to emphasize three layers, histological layers of the heart. And some of the names are familiar. Like, no one in this room has any trouble, I don't think, with the term epicardium. Where is that in the heart? How do you know that? Because the epi. So which one of these three layers is on the inside of the heart wall? Endo, and why is that? Endo means in the inside. Like endomysium and endoneurium. By the way, endoneurium separates nerve fibers. Endoneurium is not part of a nerve fiber. It separates them and keeps them separate and distinct, which was one of the questions on the exam. Myocardium, then, is the layer in between, and that's where all the cardiac muscle is. And we also find in the myocardium a fairly rigid connective tissue network where the valves are, where the aortic valve and the pulmonary valve, but especially where the mitral valve and the tricuspid valve are located. We have a very strong, stiff connective tissue layer that's sometimes called the cardiac skeleton. Obviously not bone, is it? But it's It's very firm connective tissue. The endocardium of the heart consists of what that's in contact with the blood?
Endothelium.
And why did you say that? Because blood is always in contact with endothelium, regardless of where it is, except for one place, which we'll get to today. So endocardium is simple squamous epithelium and some sub-endothelial connective tissue. What's the same layer? What's the same layer in an artery called? What's exactly the same tissue, exactly the same layer? What's its name in an artery? The intima, same structure. Okay, let's go to a little farther out, to the heart wall, where all the muscle is, called the myocardium. What's the exact same layer in a blood vessel called? It's going to be media, but what's the difference? Media has what? Muscle. Myocardium has cardiac muscle. So it's fun as a student of anatomy, when you're a graduate student, you get to follow the sections through the blood vessels and into the heart, where you see in the tunica media of the artery, all of a sudden, the smooth muscle cells become cardiac muscle cells. Fantastic transition there. What's the epicardium analogous to? In a blood vessel. Tunica adventitia. And so what do you expect to find then in the epicardium if in fact it's tunica adventitia? Connective tissue. Loose connective tissue, exactly. You find connective tissue, and you might find even some little blood vessels in the epicardium. There's a little twist, however. Little twist here, and that is that clinicians, practicing doctors, prefer to call the epicardium the visceral pericardium. They're exactly equivalent terms. Visceral pericardium and epicardium are equal. And the connective tissue that's part of the epicardium actually sub-epicardial, but epicardial connective tissue, and a little bit beneath it is loose connective tissue. And of course, the heart is surrounded by a cavity called the pericardial cavity. You'll have all kinds of chance to look at that in gross anatomy. Conduction system of the heart. Have you studied that in physiology yet? A little bit, huh? So we have some structures that are modified muscle cells, modified cardiac muscle cells. They don't have too many myofibrils. They don't have much in terms of sarcomeres. A little bit, though. But that's not their function to contract. Even though they have these contractile elements to a small degree, their principal function is to conduct action potentials. And so they're more like a nerve fibers, even though they look like cardiac muscle cells. Actually, they look a little bit like both. So the sinoatrial node, do you know where it's at? Right atrium, wall of the right atrium. And of course, it sets the pace of the heartbeat, so it's called the pacemaker of the heart. And then the atrioventricular node is between the atria and ventricle. Between the atria and ventricle, locked firmly in the cardiac skeleton. And the atrioventricular bundle is the continuation of this little lump, the node. This is a continuation of this little lump into the right and left ventricular wall. And here's a picture of that, the sinoatrial node in the wall of the right atrium, and the atrioventricular node at the junction between right atrium and right ventricle, and the atrioventricular bundle spreads the signal through the right and left ventricle. And when you study electrocardiograms and you study the cardiac cycle and physiology, you'll realize what's happening in terms of the timing of events in the cardiac cycle depend upon this conduction system. What happens if the person has a heart attack and it loses blood supply to this area of the heart here, and the left bundle becomes destroyed? Anybody ever work in a hospital setting where the electrocardiogram spits out the answer nowadays? You can have the doctor look at it, but these fancy electrocardiograms will take the signal and process it and come up with a hypothetical diagnosis. And the diagnosis would be left bundle block. What does left bundle block mean? It means the signal has stopped. It has been blocked right there. And so what's the myocardium going to do over here now? Well, it's going to try to decide when it's supposed to contract. It doesn't need that bundle. It doesn't need these action potential fibers. And so the cells will kind of contract when they think it's time to contract. And that produces something called, what? An arrhythmia. Arrhythmia. Okay, enough of that. One last topic, the lymphatic vessels. They're a lot like blood capillaries, but we'll call them lymph capillaries. And one of the major differences is that a lymph capillary begins as a blind ending tube. It has no connection at one end. And you saw in the drawings that these capillaries are found in the vicinity, these lymphatic capillaries are found in the vicinity of a blood capillary bed. And you know that the reason they're there is to take away tissue fluid. And these lymph capillaries all kind of come together from all of our capillary beds in most places of our body, and then dump into the beginning of the left subclavian vein up here. And there's a smaller one that goes into the base of the right subclavian vein. The one on the left side is called the thoracic duct, cisterna chyli, I guess. Basic organization is they start out as blind-ended tubes. There's no circulation in the sense of blood vessel circulation because the circulation begins in a blind-ended tube. So there's no continuous circulation. If the lymphatics are blocked or otherwise absent, then we expect that patient will show puffy areas of edema. These lymphatic capillaries are designed such that they will bring lymph to one of these lymphoid organs. So as lymph drains from our capillary beds in our arms and legs, and heads off to somewhere, what is the destination of these five choices here where that lymph is purified, filtered? Well, not purified necessarily. Which one of these lymphoid organs receives lymphatic capillary? Lymph node. Lymph nodes in our axilla, lymph nodes in our inguinal region, lymph nodes wherever they might be in our neck are receiving lymphatic capillary flow, and an immune reaction could be initiated by the stuff that reaches our lymph nodes. Thymus has some lymphatic capillaries too, but there's nothing going into it. There's no lymph flow into the thymus. There is lymph flow out, though. that interesting? What does that suggest? If there's vessels going out, but nothing coming in, what do you think about that? Yeah, the thymus is making lymph cells. And that's the origin of the T lymphocyte. Origin of T lymphocyte. What's the difference between lymph node and spleen? We have lymphocytes in all of these lymphoid organs. Well, what's the difference between what the function of lymph nodes is and what function of the spleen is over here, about the size of my fist over here, a little bigger than my fist over here? What's the difference in function? The spleen filters the blood, removes antigens from the blood, and the lymph node does what? Filters antigens from our lymph, not from the blood. So one's a lymph filter, and the other's a blood filter. And a thymus makes T cells. And what the heck? Let's take the tonsils out. And let's remove that appendix because they're just wasted anyway.
So with some of these organs, like the spleen or the tonsils, when they take them out, how does your body, if you can survive without them, what is your body doing to accommodate that?
It's accommodated by the fact that we have this huge redundancy of lymphocyte population. Take out the tonsils, you still have lymph nodes everywhere, you still have spleen, and you still might have appendix. So lose one out of five, big deal. Actually, it's a big deal. Because you've lost a lymphocytic circle called Waldeyer's ring, which is one of the early places that antigens can be identified in an immune reaction. So now you have to wait until the antigens get farther down in your gut to be identified.
So while this wouldn't disable your immune system, it definitely hinders it though, to have more.
The question has always been, is if you remove the tonsils, does that compromise function? And, you know, what's the answer from an MD?
No.
Take it out. It's just, wait. Well, how many tonsils do you have? Two, four, and six. So when they remove the tonsils, which one do they normally remove? The palatine tonsils. The one that, and you can see these big lobs in here. And by the way, you have four other ones. You have the pharyngeal tonsils, and you have the lingual tonsils. So you take two out of the six. What happens to the other four that remain? They get bigger. Okay, the question I think that you're asking is, if you take away the spleen, you only have one spleen.
Yeah.
So what's going to happen now?
It's not filtering.
You don't have this natural filter of the blood anymore. So when you study embryology, you'll find out that the spleen was a site of making blood cells a long time ago when we were in the womb. And the liver was a site that made blood cells during embryonic development. Well, to make a long story short, you take out the spleen, and the liver and bone marrow take over that function totally. The liver is very friendly and very accommodating. Take out the spleen here, and the liver gets bigger to accommodate the same function.
So the liver starts being the natural blood filter?
Yep. The liver, and we're gonna find in next week these cells in the liver that can do exactly the same thing. They don't do it as avidly for strep. Streptococcal organisms and staph aureus. All the other bacteria are fine. So the spleen will take out bacteria from the blood because it's filtering the blood, When the liver takes over, because the person doesn't have a spleen, they have much greater risk of dying of staph and strep infections because the liver doesn't quite do the same quality job. Why would you remove the spleen? Automobile accident. Otherwise, you're going to bleed to death. Yes. The tonsils and appendix are areas of concentrated lymphocytes that initiate immune reactions when antigens reach them. And my best guess is for the tonsils that the antigens get to the tonsils right from the air. And since the appendix is part of our GI tract, I would suspect that antigens get there through the lumen of the gut, or maybe even through the bloodstream. You have tonsils. Oh, and by the way, you have gallbladder and vault. Sorry about that. You have a digestive tract where lymphocytes are concentrated in an offshoot of the colon. But we also have gut-associated lymphoid tissue in the small intestine and throughout the digestive tract beneath the mucosa of the digestive tract. And so this gallbladder will undergo hyperplasia and increase in size. My best guess is that removing the appendix has much less effect than removing tonsils. That's my guess. Back in the back there. Vault means bronchus associated. We have no evidence in accepted scientific practices that removing the appendix would have any effect on developing food allergies, but I wouldn't want to remove this. Gut-associated lymphoid tissue, or now you're in trouble for sure. We'll talk about that when we get to it. What's appendicitis? When you have appendicitis, it's the only reason to remove the appendix. Bugs in the gut, the lumen, bacteria. And so when a person has acute appendicitis, they have lots of pus and lots of bacteria that have destroyed the appendix. You've got to take it out and say it's for 5 because if they have acute appendicitis, now they've got probably a maximum of 48 hours to live. If it's perforated. If it's not perforated, then 5 pairs. When you look at A, B, C, D, those lymphoid organs have a capsule on their surface, a dense, irregular, connective tissue capsule. That's tonsils, lymph nodes, spleen, thymus, appendix really doesn't. But gault and vault, a very interesting new addition to the list of lymphoid organs, they're not encapsulated. They don't have a collagen capsule around them, and they're not separate organs. In fact, the lymphocytes that make up the bulk of these areas are diffusely arranged. And we'll see that as you go through the digestive tract. And as we go through the respiratory tract, we'll see that lymphocytes are strung along the epithelium in a very strategic way to receive antigens from air and from food. Lymphatic vessels here are like blood capillaries, except they have this interesting fold in the endothelium, where the endothelial cells lap over one another instead of butt end to end. And this lapping over, when something is in the lymphatic vessel, it can't get out very well because this acts as a valve. However, things can get in pretty well because this valve opens when stuff comes into the lymph. When stuff tries to get out of the lymph, that has a natural valve-like action which prevents the stuff from getting out easily. And lymphatic vessels have valves because they, again, are a low-pressure system, very low-pressure system, and we don't want the lymph to flow backwards, just like in veins. Okay, time for break again. We'll start the immune system and start looking at the spleen.